Welcome to our quarterly conference call. It's February the 7th. I'm David Rothberg, and with me this morning, as he is every quarter, is Al Friedberg. Al, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
How are you today? How are you today?
Good. Good.
Good. Okay, a little bit of housekeeping first. To say that we'll keep the call to about 45 minutes. And I act as an interlocutor, and I'm going to put a couple of questions to Al, and I'm going to put a number of questions that have been sent by investors and interested investors. If you have questions during the call, you can email them to erot@niagaracapital.ca, erot@niagaracapital.ca. After the call is done, a podcast of it will be posted on both the Friedberg and Niagara websites. And that pretty well covers it. Let's get right to it. Al, normally the kinds of questions that we get prior to the call relate to the investments themselves, but I'm kind of taken by the quality of the questions or the type of questions that we've gotten this quarter. That's to say, because they're more about the nature of the management, more about the nature of the policies of the fund than they are about the positions that the fund is taking. I'll give you some examples. You've written that you have brought volatility down to acceptable levels by deciding to operate within an upper limit to leverage, specifically 3x the capital, yet that limit does not say anything about concentration. It could be heavily concentrated in a single asset. What restraints do you bring to bear on concentration? And another question, what are your views regarding concentration and diversification? Another question. How do you, besides leverage, can you describe other tactical changes that you plan to implement or are already implementing? I presume that these questions come in response to your more soul searching type of letter that you wrote last month. Can you speak about them?
Yeah. We've been getting a lot of more questions, a lot of more observations too about the type of management that we're doing, the type of training that we're doing. That's because we, global macro funds have not done very well in the past 3 years. This morning there's a long story in the Wall Street Journal about one of the most brilliant exponent of the hedge fund business, the Tiger funds, and showing also that they're down. They were down last year by a very large amount. I think that the global macro fund space is going through a re-examination of their methods, a re-evaluation of their methods, and it's something that we have to do because markets change, markets adapt, and there is no such a thing as a strategy that can stay still and be applied continuously. There is one. That is the Warren Buffett strategy, which is simply you buy good value and you sit with it. But of course, that assumes that everything will continue to be more or less the same as it's been for the last 50 or 60 years, which is, yes, we will go through some declines, we'll go through some economic crises, but generally speaking, the world and the U.S., specifically the U.S., will do very well. And there's no doubt about it. So if you take that view, then of course it's relative. I would say it's almost relatively easy to invest money. All you have to do is concentrate on value and just stay with it. Global macro fund managers are a little bit more skeptical than that, and they say, well, just because it happened once, or just because it happened for 50 years, it doesn't mean that it will continue to happen that way. We have already seen. examples where we came very close to complete breakdown, like 74 and even recently 87, and but even more recently 2008, where we were very, very close to the end. And by the end, I mean, a breakdown of the financial system and so on. So we can't always assume, or we as a class don't assume that this will continue. And so if we don't make that assumption, then we have to create some strategies that can navigate through these potential problems. So it hasn't been good for us because, markets have done well for the past few years, and as a result, compared to that type of attitude, compared to the attitude of, well, let's buy it, things will work out, we haven't done well. But we don't think that this is that's a permanent feature, and we do at some point for some more difficult markets, in where assets don't necessarily all go up and don't necessarily all produce the kind of results that we have seen. So we have to revalue it. We have to reexamine what we were doing, and that means the first step that we're doing is not really it's not related to our views of certain markets and our scenarios that we develop, but it has to do with tactics. And so tactics have taken a front place in our thinking for now for well over a year, and we this is important for us. We need to implement changes, and I believe those changes will be very very useful, and it will put us in a good position when we finally find the right scenarios, or when the scenarios play out as we think they will. So,
now, Al, if you let me just interrupt for a second, I should just point out for listeners that we're speaking, when we're talking about tactical changes in the questions that I put to you at the outset, these relate to the global macro fund, the leverage fund. The asset allocation fund would also properly be characterized as a global macro fund in that it shares the views of the global macro, the leverage fund, but it does so in an unleveraged basis, and it only is long, it's not short, so it's not plagued by the same kind of tactical considerations that have to be applied to the global macro fund, just to make that point clear. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Okay, so going back, tactical changes. So we have implemented a number of them, and over time, the most important one was the one where we had to seek that level of leverage that was going to be comfortable enough for us. And that's because we came to the conclusion, I have explained this many times before, but we came to the conclusion that in a way we couldn't count on what's called uncorrelated positions. We just couldn't count on that. We couldn't say, we can build a very large portfolio on $100 of capital. We can build a portfolio of $1,000 as long as $500 were of one kind and the other $500 were going to offset that in case there was a problem. So that really we had a very small net exposure. We couldn't do that. We saw that we couldn't do that. We tried it in 2012, 13, 14, and it just wouldn't work. And actually, when we examine it, we see that it's just too difficult an act. We can't predict in advance correlations. We cannot predict them. Statistically, they're there, but then they can change overnight. And so we decided, you know what? Every single position has to be considered in a way correlated, ultimately. And therefore, if that's the case, we cannot build a portfolio of $1,000 on a $100 capital base. We need to bring that down, and we found a level. We believe that that's the right level. We found a level of somewhere between $250 and $300. For every $100 of capital, we can build between $250 and $300 worth of positions. So 2.5 to 3 to 1. 2.5 to 1, 3 to 1 is sort of our level of comfort. It's our level of comfort given markets today. As you know, in the asset allocation, for example, we have a 1 to 1. So but it's not leveraged. But if we wanted to leverage and we wanted to have what we may call dramatic results, unusual results, then we could allow ourselves to go up to 3 to 1. And so far, that has worked well. Even as we did not perform well last year, our volatility levels were very, very much in line with what we expected. They were not very high, and we are satisfied. So that was our step number one. But then we've been adding other tactical changes, which I think are very important. For example, we have not taken the view that it is almost impossible, almost impossible given the high level of sophistication that we find today in the market, the tremendous amount of players, of intelligent players in the market, of informed players in the market. We find that it's literally impossible to be able to outperform indices. In other words, we cannot build a strategy based on the fact that we will be the first ones to discover a huge winner, a Google or a Facebook or Nvidia, or any of these stocks that eventually turn out to be major outperformers. We can't do that. I don't think that it's possible to do that. I think that those who have tried it, the active funds have tried it, they cannot do well. They are losing ground. And maybe the day will come when there will be one year in which they will do well. It's possible because, you know, we are sort of eliminating the weaker players. So you the stronger players stay in, and maybe there are a few stronger players that eventually will be able to outperform the index. But generally speaking, we don't think that that's where we can be. We cannot be there. So if we want to play something, a sector, if you want to do anything in the equity market, we want to do sectors. We're saying when it comes to sector allocation, there is more inefficiency. We can say, for example, that we think that we can say, for example, that home builders will do better than the financial sector, or that oil and gas will do better than the financial sector, or whatever. Sectors for us is a more interesting way of playing the market. We don't have to get into the nitty-gritty, the details of the individual companies, and we will. So this was a tactical decision. We no longer, I mean, there may be some exception once in a while, but this is not the way we want to do it. We no longer choose individual stocks. What we do is we say we go with the sector. And so that's a theme. We call it a theme or a sector, whatever you may call it. But that's become entrenched into one of our tactical changes. Another tactical change that we've made, and I believe that this is good because this brings us back maybe to the old roots, to the way we used to make money in the 70s, 80s, 90s, which was a testament to reality. We want to make sure that the position that we're taking is a position that will accrue benefits to the fund in a significant manner, in a material manner. So we won't put on a position because that will let's say bring us a profit of if we do well that'll bring us a profit of 2% or 3% of the fund. That's for us not material. We have now established a new threshold. We want to make at least a 10% return for the fund in any position that we're taking. And so that testament to reality is important because it eliminates a lot of trades. And there's a lot of trades that we think that can do well, that may be able to make us money, that actually over the next 30 days we are pretty sure, and you know nobody's ever sure, but that we feel pretty sure, that they will show some profit. We won't do those. We want trades that when we put them on will produce a minimum of 10% return. Now, of course, those are larger trades, but of course, we also look at the risk side. So if we think the risk is very large, and if the risk was going to be 10% of the fund and the upside is 10%, then of course we wouldn't put it on. But the point is that the position has to pass that threshold. The expectation has to pass that threshold. We got to make at least 10% return. So that's what we call the testament to reality. We've spoken about themes and leverage. The other thing that we want to do is very important for us to do, and it's sort of like a pillar of what we're doing is optionality. Where possible, we try to take positions that have some optionality to them, so that it could do more in a way. And we're buying it for free, practically. We buy optionality for free because we've taken a position for a certain reason, for a certain target, for a certain objective. But there is an option built in there that we don't pay for that can give us a lot more room and a lot more upside.
Can you give an example?
Well, optionality, for example, is
I think free. When you speak about an option for free, what? Give an example.
Well, for free, I don't have to pay. Like, generally speaking, you pay for an option, right? You buy an option, you pay for an option.
Of course,
some
you pay the
things
premium.
You have to. What's that?
You buy the premium. You pay the premium.
You buy the premium. You have a premium, but sometimes some positions you buy for a certain reason that you see the economics of it, but then there is something built in there that, in addition to that, I'll just give you one example. For example, the oil market. As an example, the oil market is a market that for the most part is run by daily supply and demand and expectations of supply and demand. And we know what's happening with the OPEC, and we know what's happening in the shale country. You know, generally, and we know what's happening with demand and so on. And so the picture that's being portrayed at the moment is that oil should continue to rise a little bit more as we draw down inventory. So we have an economic picture, right? We have an economic picture. There is very little built into the price structure or into the option market itself that relates to an unusual event. For example, a confrontation between the U.S. and Iran. There's very little today in the option market that says that. If the option markets were more rational, they probably would build something in there. Maybe not under the old former administration, where the Obama administration was willing to be more appeasing to the Iranians. But with the new administration, it's clear that some confrontation at some point will take place. And we saw that already in the first few days of the Trump administration. We saw the Iranians testing them, launching this missile, and the U.S. reacting. And yet, interestingly enough, there is no real reaction in the price or in the option market. And so what I'm saying is when you've taken a position in the price, you may be taking a position for economic reasons, that you've calculated that demand will outstrip supply at these levels and that inventories will be brought down to reasonable levels, et cetera. But you're not paying for that extra risk. And I can go through different positions, but...
No, this, I understand. Thank you.
Yeah, this is what I mean, that you don't pay for that optionality, right? Sometimes you get it for free.
Right.
And I think that maybe the last point I want to make is that, and this is, I wouldn't call this tactical, but I would call it more strategic, that we are trying to take positions today that are outside the fringes of discussion. And I think that's very important because one of our traders said at our desk is that positions get crowded very quickly. Let's start first with something else. There's a lot of talk in the financial media about things that are happening and about the Fed and about wages and about the economy and about many, many, many things. There's a discussion, and that discussion is heated. We see it every day, and you get many, many different opinions. You can watch it on TV, you can read in the newspaper. There's many opinions about certain things, and most of the time they're binary type of opinions. Yes, they will, no, they won't, that kind of a thing. Increasingly, we're trying to stay out of those discussions. In other words, the positions that we're taking are not being discussed, at least for now. They're not discussed in any big way. They're not the center of discussion. We are at the fringes of the discussion. And it's important for us to stay there in the fringes, because if we stay in the middle, first of all, the markets are fairly efficient, so they seem to navigate between the yes-sayers and the naysayers. It seems to navigate fairly well. And they get very crowded very quickly, too. There's a lot of positions there. So we don't want to be there. We want to be in things that are not being discussed very much or not being discussed at all. And I can give you an example. And wait until they become the center of discussion. And I believe at that point you can decide to take some profits if you want to. But the idea is we have to ask ourselves, are we getting ourselves into the discussion when we take the position, or we are not getting into the discussion? Yes.
Go ahead. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's so I've now reviewed the tactical changes and maybe one part of a strategic change.
I was going to circle back to the issue of concentration and diversification. You and I have had this discussion, and of the 10 questions that have been sent to us by investors, two of them relate to that. But before I get to that, I think that if we were to talk about the portfolio today, it would illustrate what you mean by the discussion that exists beyond the fringes. Because some of the positions that we do have in the portfolio are not, we don't have Apple, and we're not making bets on whether or not the 210 will go above 1.25. We're operating a little bit on the margins. Maybe you could talk about those a little bit and illustrate what you mean.
Right. So, there's some better examples and worse examples. Some of them are really good examples. Some of them are not as good, but they fit. For example, yes, we're not into the Apples of the world and the Facebooks and so on, because that's been discussed endlessly. But we are, for instance, in a position like the Greek banks, which are really not discussed practically. And in fact, the Greeks happen to be in a bad spot. If you look at what's happening, by sometime in mid-July, end of July, creditors have to come to an agreement with Greece. It looks like a standoff. It looks like it's not going to work. It looks like the Germans will probably not go along with refinancing them. And if they don't refinance them, there is default. Some of their bonds have already beginning to price in a default. We're getting some very high yields in some of them, or most of their bonds. So the discussion there is whether there will be default or there won't be a default, and that seems to be sort of like the discussion. We are taking a position at the fringes of it. We're saying, you know what? Either way, we think that the Greek banks will do well. And so now we're in the fringe of it, because we're saying if the Greeks are bailed out again, and if more money is given to them, and their economy is improving at the moment, so it is continuing to improve, the balance sheets of these banks have improved, their profit statements are starting to, they're starting to show profits. So if there is such a thing, great. But if there is default, and if Greece leaves Grexit, if they exit the European community, there is another interesting alternative for us, which is they probably will have to have a monetary system in place. My guess is that after so much time, they already planned it. They know exactly what to do. They probably will do it on a weekend. They probably will print their new drachmas. They will have the system in place. I would have to think that has to be done. It cannot be ad hoc. I mean, it's something that has been discussed already. And we know it was discussed a year and 2 years ago. So if they do that, in that case, the banks will do very well, too, because we know that for the first 2 years of a very large devaluation, the economy does very well. If they're careful and they do things well, the economy can continue to do very well for many years to come. But even if they're not that careful, and there's going to be a spurt, a very strong spurt in economic growth, and that will do very well for the banks. So we have here a situation where we can have a position. Now, we cannot have too large of a position, and that's because they're not very liquid, these banks. You cannot take huge positions. We always have to worry about exit, and as it is today, we have the largest possible position we can own, which is about 7% of the fund, without incurring major liquidity problems. But it's material, right? It's material, because if we are right, these banks will probably appreciate 200 to 300%, and so that will give us that will pass the materiality test.
If there's a default, you get paid in euros, or you get paid in new drachmas.
You'll get paid in if there is a default, you'll get probably paid in drachmas, but the drachma at that point would be adjusted in the marketplace. I mean, there would be an exchange rate between the drachma and the euro, the drachma and the dollar, and my guess is that in the end, the real value of what you're getting will be similar. So, you know, it may be a greater appreciation in drachma, but at the exchange rate prevailing then, It will be probably enough for us to see these banks trade closer to maybe 0.7 or 0.8% of book.
I think that likewise, so, your position, Brazilian bonds, illustrates
the Brazilian bonds they're a little bit of a different kind, but certainly, first of all, they do pass the concentration. We are heavily concentrated, very heavily concentrated in Brazil. But by the way, we think it's probably the best single country play in the world today. It's probably the only country in the world today that is carrying out economic reform of the right kind. They have put a cap on spending, a long-term cap on spending, which is remarkable. They have inflation adjusted, but still a long-term cap. They are making very large changes to their pension program that will bring it back to sustainable levels, and that will be passed hopefully in the next 2 or 3 months. The government has now control of the Congress, of the lower and the upper chambers. They have control of it. The privatizations are going on in not just at the federal level, but even at the city level. There's very large attempts to privatize all kinds of different businesses and companies at the city level, São Paulo, Rio, and other jurisdictions. They're trying to get rid of stuff that they realize, these states who have been in bad financial condition, they realize that they need to privatize, they need to get rid of these albatrosses, and so we have privatization. This privatization will attract a great deal of capital from abroad, which is what's underpinning the value of the currency. So, for example, here we have, in Brazil, we have a position that's equal to 50%, the bond position. And let me backtrack for a second. Brazil is the focus of discussion in some of the emerging market, in some of the emerging market funds. So emerging market funds represent a slice of the total investment market. It's not the main discussion among the big hedge funds or among the big long only funds. And so it's only a slice, and in that slice, there's a lot of people who do recognize that Brazil is doing well. However, interestingly, they have mostly restricted themselves to dollar bonds, Brazilian dollar bonds, and they're playing the spread. We have maintained that you can play the local bond market, and the local bond market denominated in real. So we have a double exposure. We have a long bond exposure, and we have had a real exposure, and both of them are doing well. And we continue to think that the real will do well and the bond will do well. And so, again, we are staying a little bit outside of most of the discussion. We don't see very much of that. We are what we call on the fringes. And until that becomes mainstream or until that becomes a topic of major conversation, we will be there. But it's concentration. Right? So going back to concentration, that's concentration. We have a large concentration in there. If you take the bonds and the currency, they're two different types, but they're somewhat related. We have 100% of capital in that position, right?
Right. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about concentration and diversification.
Yes.
If you're lowering leverage and at the same time restricting yourself to positions that are going to produce a significant return to the fund, which you've defined roughly as a 10% return, you run the risk of having a very small number of positions. And you, who are not especially attuned to correlation or don't believe so much in correlations, are by many conventional notions at least, leaving yourself vulnerable. Can you talk about this?
So, okay. So first I want to make a comment. You say you run the risk. And that's not true. We run a risk. We don't run the risk. We know that we're running risk. And so, yes, concentration. But I'm going to backtrack now, too, again, and say this. We've examined our performance for the past maybe 40 years. We've been trading since the very early 70s. So we've been trading very close to 50 years. And notice that the big gains, were never made out of diversified portfolios. The big gains were always made out of being right once or maybe twice in specific positions. And since I was brought up as a child, I remember my father mentioning to me Gerald Loeb, who wrote an interesting book on investments. And I remember him saying, and it was endorsed by my father, I remember that too. I remember him saying that forget diversification. Put all your eggs in one basket, but watch the basket. That's what you should do. Watch the basket.
Watch the basket. Exactly.
That's right. And that's what we are now, and that's what we've done well, and that's what we have to try to get back to. We've tried to get back to concentrated positions, which we need to watch them very carefully, of course. And I'll come back to what, and this is new. I mean, new, when I say new, I mean new for the past 6, 7, 8, 10 years maybe. But I'll come back to what restraints these positions have, or what restraints we have put on those positions. But at any rate, we need concentrated positions. And we need to watch them very, very closely. And we need to return to that. And that's why materiality is important, because materiality will bring us back to the that type of posture. All right? And so now your question is, yes, we run risk, and of course we run risk. And that's where, and we need to be careful, what risk are we running? And so I've said this before. I still think that this is what we need to do. First, the overall leverage cap will keep us from being in terrible trouble, because 3-to-1 is we never will have one position representing 3-to-1. We may have three positions representing 3-to-1, but not one. And the reason is simple, because we cannot allow, or we don't want to allow. Any position or the total portfolio to drop in one day more than 3%. And so we have to ask ourselves, given historical precedent, we have to ask ourselves, is this size of a position going to produce a daily drop or an overnight drop of more than 3%? And if it does, then it's too large. So that's the restraint that we put on them. So that is really the protection of being overly, overly concentrated, right? But we do like concentration, and we think that we really should never have more than five positions. That would be ideal, absolutely ideal. In fact, today we're very close to the ideal point, and I think that we have a chance now with some of these to do very, very well. And I want to come back to something that we haven't done for many years, which wasn't the days that we used to trade commodities only. And that was the idea of pyramiding. In the days of commodities, you took a position, and if it went well, you didn't take the entire position on day one. You took a smaller position on day one. And then if it went well, you pyramided that position. The majority of commodity traders who did pyramiding, A, lost money, but B, the reason they lost money was because they didn't have the money. What they did is they started with $5,000. They put on a position. As the market moved their way, they had equity accumulating, paper money accumulating, paper profits accumulating, and they used the paper profits, which the commodity markets allow, they used the paper profits to pyramid, to increase their position. That's a losing proposition. That's a losing proposition, because any reaction in the market will make you liquidate. You'll have to liquidate. You don't have enough money. You're out. But the best feature of pyramiding is the fact that psychologically and factually, it's moving in the direction that you think the market is going to move. That's what pyramiding really does. If I buy XYZ on day one, and I say XYZ will go up because their earnings will do well, the company is doing well, and maybe the market is skeptical, but XYZ moves up and continues to move up, and then I gain more confidence, and I say, you know what, I'm probably right, and now I add to the position, right? And then I keep adding to the position. So pyramiding is not done as a way to earn money and earn enough money to increase the position, but pyramiding is done as a way to say, my hunch, my intuition is correct, and things are moving in that direction. So we want to do that. We want to return to that. We want to return to that thing which says we take a position, We like the position. We'll take a position that's material. And if things go the way we think they go and quietly move in that direction and they remain on the fringes of discussion, then we may be able to pyramid, and we will pyramid. And that's where we think, and that's where we did well in the past, and that's where we think we're going to do well. Okay?
Well, you're talking about a situation. Yeah, okay? As far as pyramiding goes, it depends upon momentum, which has been in short supply and has resulted in returns that have been as difficult for commodity trading advisors to depend upon.
Oh, right. But I'm interrupting you, David. I'm not talking about commodities only or commodities only. I'm talking about anything, any position that we're taking may be that case. I mean, for example, it may be Brazil. Well, in Brazil's case, we probably wouldn't go above what we already have, which is large. But we did, by the way, a few months ago, add to the position when it went our way. A small amount we added to the position. Maybe we added 10% to the position. And in that case, it was already large. But if, for instance, we were to see the Greek banks react well under unfavorable news, in an unfavorable news environment, And liquidity is getting better. There's more volume, there's more trading, and it's going our way. We may decide to pyramid there. So I don't use pyramiding in the commodity sense. I use it in the sense of, is the market, are we being vindicated in our thought? And if so, are we being a little more confident, and are we adding to that position?
I see.
Right, because of that.
Okay.
So I think I answered your question of concentration. Yes, we are more concentrated. We want to be more concentrated. We want to watch that basket very carefully. But I think that that's where we're going to make some substantial returns.
Good. Okay. Thank you. It sounds reasonable, and it sounds positive. I remember those days.
No, it's not reasonable.
Well,
it's not reasonable. It's not reasonable. It's exciting. It's not reasonable. It's exciting.
Thank you. Look, the two of us have been talking on the phone now for over a half an hour, and not once have you mentioned Donald Trump. I don't think that it can go on, and it's not even a second longer. The world can't take it. What policies do you think the new administration are going to affect that will be most significant as far as macro players in general and you in particular are concerned? How does it change the landscape? What do we do? How do we act? How do we live?
Okay.
How do we behave? How do we talk? How do we think?
Right. If we can talk, because he may be tweeting over your talk, and you may not be able to talk.
Exactly.
Right. So, let's see. We're talking about what kinds of policies coming out of the administration will make a difference in how we position towards that, or
exactly.
In relation to that. Well, one of them is.
Exactly.
I believe that he's a person that is willing, or is a person, his administration, because he has people with him, willing to take greater risk than the previous administration for the purpose of maybe what you may call in general, although he doesn't have that vision. He's not a Pax Americana vision. I think that he's simply saying this is the best for our own needs in our own situation, but he's willing to take greater political military risk than the previous administration. For example, it was not accidental, clearly not accidental, that the Iranians launched a missile just a few days after he became president. They were going to test, or they wanted to test the result of this administration compared to the previous one, which allowed 11 missile launches. It never said a word, or maybe said something, but nobody heard it. You saw the immediate response. There was an immediate response that they were put on notice, and there were already sanctions imposed. So we have an administration that is willing actually to take greater risk, to the point, I believe, that they will make good on those risks. To the point that if there is anything that happens, the U.S. will probably move warships in that area and put increasing pressure to get what they want to do. So that says if there's going to be more risk, you have to be careful of very discrete, large moves. you will not get gradual type moves, but you'll get some very sharp move. For example, you could have, as I said before, a very large increase in the price of oil overnight, practically, if there is some kind of a conflict, right? Or you can get some very large a problem with the Chinese, let's say, and dispute over their islands. You maybe get a confrontation that can have an impact on, a very sharp impact on, for example, the price of gold. So you will get some very sharp moves, okay? And that, by the way, is why optionality is very important, because if you don't pay for that optionality, if you don't pay much money for that, and if the market is not recognizing that, you can get free money. You practically get free money. So that's one thing. I think that this administration is willing to take is going to be less harmonized with a central bank, and it will take fiscal. They will adopt fiscal policies that will not necessarily fit with what the central bank expects. So they may want to push resources to their maximum. They may want to get the U.S. unemployment rate. Maybe they don't care. Maybe the Trump administration, it's possible, may not care to bring unemployment down below 4% or below 3.5%. It's possible. It's an administration that's intent in making sure that the average worker gets a job, anybody who wants to get a job gets a job, and may be willing to run risk and clash with the Fed. Now, what does that mean? For us, it means that rates are likely to go up. Interest rates are likely to go up faster at some point once the Fed gets out of its timid position. Rates will probably go up faster than we think. So that's another thing. We are taking positions in that area as long as we're doing it without taking unusual risk. For example, the market expects now, when we took the position, the market expected at the most two raises in 2017. Two raises of 25 basis points, which is about 50 basis points. Now the market has shifted.
Short euro dollar futures.
Short euro interest rates and Fed funds, which is a bet on interest rates. I bet an interest rate, right. So when we took the position, the market maybe expected 1.5 to 2 times moves. Now we've shifted closer to 2.5 times moves. When we took the position, we already took that into account, but it was not expensive to bet on higher rates. We think that those higher rates will come. And they may not come in 2017, but they will come suddenly and strongly and violently in 2018. So again, here's a way that the new administration could influence or is influencing already our positions. The other very interesting thing that is not talked a lot about, but I think that you see it, and that is the Trump administration seems to have a view. They don't like the European zone. They don't like the European community set up, and they out there to undermine it. And you can see that. I think that they're offering the British help in their negotiations. Help means simply, you know, we'll make a very good free trade agreement with you. You don't need the Europeans. You can be strong. You can then negotiate with a strong hand. Or the other day, a comment that the euro was being was too low, and they were stealing market share from our exports. Again, the idea is to undermine the European community. Now, it's true that the latter has been admitted by the Germans. The Germans do think that for the phase that they're in now, the euro is probably too low. It should be higher, but they also recognize that for the peripheral countries, the euro is still too high. So, again, here we have something that it's subtle, but it could gain strength, which is, and in France, for example, you see that the far-right party, the right-wing party, is aligning itself in a way, with the Trump administration, and the idea being that a global movement towards this type of nationalistic policies is developing. Now that is a a warning signal that the European community may be on its last legs. And if it is on its last legs, then you want to have to find ways that you can trade that. So these three that I just mentioned are good examples of where the new administration can lead us into positions or can support some of the positions that we have today. And I think I've answered that, right? I mean,
yes, you have. You haven't spoken about the political risk affecting your gold position in the asset allocation fund. You own gold mining shares there.
Right, right. In the asset allocation, well, we like the way the mining stocks are done. They've done well. They had a huge correction in the fourth quarter of last year, and it almost shook us out. But we were fairly confident that they were doing well. There was rationalization going on in the industry. The price was holding above, well above their cost. There was a lot of more mergers. There was a lot more, rationalization of cost, and that they will continue to do well. They have come back. They're doing well. We think that with a stable gold price in the $1,200 to $1,300, the mining stocks will continue to do well, and that's where our position is in the asset allocation. We don't own bullion, but we own the mining stocks, which represent 20 to 25% of the portfolio.
Okay, so you're not thinking that the Trump administration is going to affect the political risk, which is going to find its way into gold, and that we're going to see gold at 2,000.
No, gold. I think gold will react. In my view, gold will react mostly to accelerating inflation, and we have to see it before it happens. We actually have to see. Well, gold will react to accelerating inflation, to negative real rates. We'll see how the Fed reacts now. If the Fed doesn't react strongly, if the Fed doesn't react firmly, then gold will do well. The political thing is sort of the extra icing on the cake. But the underlying main economic forces are inflation and real rates, and those are starting to look like they're going in gold's favor, but they're also going in the favor of other hard assets too, other commodities, like silver, for example.
Okay.
Which is commodity that we own, yeah.
Just by the way, we typically try and keep the call to 45 minutes, which would mean that we should be ending it now, but we still have some very good questions, and the discussion's flowing on, so we're going to go over time today, if that's okay with you, Al.
All right.
Take a breath there. Okay. So I mentioned it because one of the questions that an astute investor wrote the following. I'll just read it to you. Apropos of what we were just talking about regarding inflation, U.S. sovereign debt stands at $20 trillion and carries an average interest rate of 1.8% for a total net interest rate bill of $280 billion. If the rate goes to 5%, this bill would increase by $441 billion. Given the Republican desire for balanced budgets, could there be a scenario where inflation is on the rise, let's say coming in at 3% year over year, and yet the Fed keeps rates artificially low as to refinance expiring debt at a quote-unquote reasonable rate?
I agree with that gentleman or gentlewoman. I agree with that. I think that the Fed will not be very quick in their reaction for political reasons, for that reason that he's giving, for reasons that they are afraid to allow the economy to relapse in their thinking. So I think the Fed will move slowly. It will at first move slowly until we have a very strongly entrenched inflationary force. I mean, just to think about it, right now, we have a Fed funds rate of 65 basis points approximately, with inflation running around 2% a year, and labor costs running around 3% a year. So we are very far behind. We are already very, very behind. And maybe that one of the considerations of the Fed governance is the federal debt. The federal debt is very large. Any increase in the federal debt, by the way, not all of it is subject to immediate changes in interest rates because a lot of it is long term. But I believe that the debt profile, the maturity is relatively short. Maybe it turns over every 4 years or so. I can remember now. But it's short. I think the longest one in the industrialized world is the UK's, which runs as high as 11 years. But other countries have very short-term maturities. I mean, the average maturity that is short term. And the reason is simple, because it was easy to do that for politicians to raise money at the short end when the yield curve is so steep. You can borrow money cheaply at the short end. So yes, there will be an impact. That impact will not necessarily go and cover the entire $20 trillion. It will cover a part of it, but it's, over time it will be costly. So that could be a consideration, and I agree. Eventually they'll have to meet, or they'll have to find a way to meet rising inflationary costs. So there's no way out of it eventually. But for now, at least for the next, who knows, 12 months, maybe 18 months, they can get away with keeping rates lower than they should.
Okay. The same investor speaks about oil. We talked about oil earlier. You were talking about the optionality of having an oil position vis-a-vis the political, a possible political issue between Iran and the United States. This notes what happened to come across my desk today in one of those newsletters that migrates around, and it spoke about the open interest in crude. The crude open interest has increased to the highest level it had been prior to the collapse of 2014, if I'm not mistaken. What do you think is happening there?
Yeah, well, on the one side, you have, I think, the longs, mostly what's called the net speculative long position, right? That's the way to call it in the commitment. So, yeah, that has risen a great deal. That's mostly hedge funds. I have to think that that's mostly hedge funds. But what's the other side of it? Who is selling? Who's selling to them positions? And it seems that producers are big sellers of oil, and you can see that because the back months are starting to flatten. And sometimes they're even a little lower in the back months. So if you go out 2, 3, 4 years. So it's probably producers, probably our own producers in the U.S. Sensing an opportunity here. They can go out and do some of their fracking and guarantee themselves a $55 price, which is profitable for them. So yes, there's sellers and there's buyers, and my sense is that is, even though it may be short-term, a vulnerable position, because we've seen that whenever the trade, the speculative contingent has gotten large, we've had reactions, sharp reactions, and I would not be surprised if crude oil dropped 10% in a matter of days, because it's vulnerable. But the other side of it is that we have a market that is very oversold, that has oversold its inventory levels. In other words, whereas inventory levels were excessive in the past, were very large, and were a bearish factor in the market, I believe that today, given the amount of hedging that's taking place, those inventory levels have been sold, quote-unquote. They already are sold. They're not a factor in the market. And so if they're not a factor in the market, we may be moving slowly into backwardation. And I think we're beginning to see that. That spot is gaining versus the back months. That means that the market may be getting tighter and will get tighter. It actually will get tighter. In my view, it will get tighter. So it won't take much of a political confrontation, military confrontation, to set off this thing and make it go a lot higher. Again, the market is more vulnerable because the longs are these funny players called hedge funds, and they're very, very fickle. And so market moves down 100 points, 150 points, and you see them selling very quickly. So you could get a 10% drop, a very quick drop. But underlying this is the fact that this market is very well sold out, and there's not going to be a lot of oil around, what you call excess oil around.
Is this the type of trade that exists well within the fringes of the discussion, and therefore something that is precluded from inclusion in the portfolio, or is this you don't have a position in oil at present?
We have a very small position in options, very almost insignificant in terms of value today, dollars today, but it could be significant if there was something happening. Very small, but significant. It is not. I don't think that a military confrontation is being discussed today. yet, anyway. And I don't think that anybody has really pointed out, like we are, that this large long short position, the large open interest position, is actually a bullish factor, longer term, structural bullish factor. If anything, most of the conversation is net speculative longs are very heavily long, and this is the highest long position, the largest long position they've had in history, and some say yes, some say no, some give excuses for it, but I don't think that the other side of it is being discussed or understood well, and it may in the course of time, but right now it's not being discussed.
Okay. Let's wind it up. I'll do the honors, and if there's something
I just want to add while you kept me extra time,
please.
And if there's anybody left on the phone, if I hear some snoring, but I'm not sure it's your guys or the audience, but
no, the guys on the treadmill yesterday. You know, they do they're working up the cardio. They'll spend an extra 15
right.
minutes.
You know,
it's good for everybody's health what we're doing.
I want to discuss a position that we took recently that I think that has a lot of potential. And it's a dynamics that's not well understood, which is, as I said before, that one of the Trump administration's subtle longer term goals may be the breakup of the European Union. Well, he cannot do it himself or by himself, and these things don't happen that way. But they do happen because of economic and financial stresses. That does happen. There's an interesting trade that is not being discussed because it's not understood that way yet, and that is this. Until now, none of the peripheral countries in Europe, with a small exception of Spain, have really undertaken significant reforms. Italy and not Portugal. Well, they're small reforms. They're not reforms. They are sort of sobriety, they call it that way. You know, they realize that they can keep spending, so they spend a little less, they raise taxes, but it's not a real reform. So the reason why they survived, even though there was a crisis 3 years ago, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, there was a very big crisis. The reason why they were able to survive was Draghi. Draghi brought down interest rates to almost zero. Some of these things, some of these countries trade at a very small premium to the German bonds. And because the interest rate was so low, it was easy for them to refinance themselves. It never created a financial crisis, the kind of crisis that the gentleman who asked us before was talking about, which is higher rates when you have a lot of debt can bankrupt you. Well, Draghi's whatever he needs policy and QE is coming to an end slowly. They already are running out of bonds to buy. They're already running out of anything to buy, practically. They already are beginning to admit that there's no deflationary risk anymore. In fact, if anything, there is some inflationary risk. Spain and Germany are showing strong inflationary pressures. So my guess is that Draghi's program, which is supposed to end sometime next year, will end probably a little earlier. And as it is already at the margin, the amounts being bought are smaller. This means that the bailout that took place for the peripheral countries, where the rates were kept at a very low rate, interest rates were kept very low, is beginning to lift. That pressure on rates, that downward pressure on rates is lifting. And that means that for all of Europe, we're going to see a rise in interest rates, a slow rise in interest rates. Now, what does that mean for the peripheral countries? And that's where it gets interesting. It means that countries that that did well when it went down did proportionally better than Germany when it went down, because they were countries that were close to bankruptcy. As rates went down, they were bailed out. And therefore, their risk premiums shrunk. By the same token, as rates go back up, their risk premium will begin to widen. So we have a double play here. And the second part of that play is not being recognized. It's not in the fringe of discussion. It's at the fringe of discussion. It's not in the center of discussion. That is, as rates rise, the premium for Italy, for Portugal, for Greece, for Spain, will begin, for even for France, will begin to rise.
At
so
a sovereign level.
Here we have something
level.
That, what's that?
At a sovereign level.
At a sovereign level. So if, let's say, you wouldn't have Draghi, if Draghi would not be around, if Draghi didn't exist, if you didn't have a concerted effort to bail out the Eurozone, if now we've come to the end of it and we say, guys, that's it, we've had enough, and the Germans realize how much money they have now put into this venture and what cost has been an astronomical cost to them, and we haven't added up all the cost. We haven't added up the target two balances. We haven't added up any of the cost, but it's astronomical. If they finally come to realization that this cannot be helped anymore, and rates begin to rise, and if you didn't have the central bank in place because they are now exhausted, you would have a interest rate spread for countries, semi-bankrupt countries like Italy, like Portugal, that are significantly higher than where they are today. Significantly higher. For example, Italy is trading around 200 basis points over bonds. It would not surprise me if it traded at 400, 500, 600, 700 basis points above the bonds, and that Italy would have to pay maybe 6, maybe 7, maybe 8% interest rate, and maybe more, and maybe more. The point is, if you go back 20 years or 25 years, you'll see that Italy on its own had an enormous premium, had to pay an enormous premium over bonds for debt. And already then they were vulnerable, or their balance sheet was atrocious. And today is, of course, much greater. I think their debt to GNP is like 140%. It's untenable. So I think this is a play. For us, it's an important play. We have taken a position. We're going to add to this position. We think that this is something exciting. That we're not predicting here, by the way, chaos. We're not predicting here apocalyptic. We don't have an apocalyptic view here. We're saying
it's not 2008. We're not talking about 2008 here. We're talking about
No. We're saying 2011 or 2012. We're saying, look, you know, without Draghi in the picture, or Draghi being marginalized, Italy must pay a higher rate of interest to stay in business. They have to. Nobody will lend them money at 200 basis points over bonds. They're going to have to pay 400 or 500 or 600 or 800 points above bonds, right? Greece yesterday or before yesterday, their bonds, their restructured bonds, which are high-quality bonds, traded above 9%. There's no reason why the Italian bonds shouldn't trade there. So this is what I mean by staying out at the fringes of discussion. This is what I mean by having optionality, and this is what I mean by having materiality. You want to have a big position, and you want to press that position until it becomes very clear to everybody what's happening, and then, of course, you're going to have to get out, right? So this is what I think is the exciting future coming up. I think 2017 will be a very, very, very interesting year for us, I think.
Well, I was going to summarize, but I think that this explanation of the position you put on with Italy really illustrates it. It illustrates materiality. It illustrates you're wanting to make a concentrated bet, a bet on a circumstance that's not being discussed. So, as you say, just beyond the fringes of discussion, and reflects well the tactical changes you've made. So I don't want to gild the lily. I think I'll just thank you for the time you spent this morning, and to all our listeners. Wish you good luck for the coming quarter, and a reminder to all investors that our discussion is going to be posted on both the Friedberg and the Niagara website. And with that, I wish us all good luck with our investing. Thanks, Al.
Okay, thank you, David. Bye, everybody.
Until next quarter. Bye-bye.
Yes, bye-bye.